The theme between now and Passover is dealing with shame. And I want you to think, I don't want you to think of, like, you know, Burnett had a hot seat about, that was allegedly about shame, but that wasn't, I mean, I don't know how to tell you this. These hot seats aren't going to be shouting matches or difficult. These hot seats are going to be points where the gentleness of the Holy Spirit will be revealed. And literally the arms of the everlasting Father will embrace you, hopefully, in the back of your brain cells at the point when you were a little child and believed the separation. So the goal of this, between now and Passover, isn't to put you on some trips about hot seats or anything like that. That's child's play anyway. The goal of this is to put you so that you can see that those times when you were that young child that was terrified because you were left alone, that while you just didn't see right, that God's arms were around you. So that there's never a time in your life when you've been alone. It's never happened. It never can happen. It never will happen. And anything that hopefully the theme of everything that we're about will be by the end of this Passover, you will be so totally certain with every muscle, nerve, and fiber in your body that you can never again be alone. You can never again be separate. And that's the spirit that I want you to feel and understand. Because so much of what has driven you has been shame-based. So much of your responses have been shame-based and a fear of separation because of a belief system in your own unworthiness. And there's this constant desperation to try to prove your worthiness and kill anybody that doesn't. And all of that childish thing it's going to be flushed down the toilet. It served its purpose. It's like the thing that we try to go through is that we think that we have to get fixed up to have unity, or we have to change to have a sense of peace and oneness. The truth is, from God's standpoint, that has always been the case. We've never been alone. We've never been separate. But it's the one lie of the universe. There's only one lie. The lie of the Antichrist. This is a party to and a part of, says that you are separate. Now, once that lie has been caused to be believed, separate from what? It doesn't matter. Separate from anything, everything. Then you end up, you know, spending the rest of your life trying to prove that you're not separate. And the more you try to prove it, all you do is prove to yourself that you are separate. It's like the Sisyphus thing in the Greek mythology, where you're rolling the rock up the hill and it's over and over, and you finally think you got it up there where you're never going to be separate again, and the rock falls back down. You have to go do the same thing over and over. And the reason is, it's because the Holy Spirit will not let you be successful in isolation. Now, remember, there's a fall. A fall took place. And the fall caused us to be separate from life. To believe that we're separate from life. We have to do something to get back to the source of life. I mean, I know all of you fairly well. What?
Barely.
Yeah.
Yay, barely.
But I mean, it's like, I know, you know, with Harry, I know which button to push. and I must confess, I push it periodically.
Periodically.
Oh, no. Oh, periodically.
He was bored.
Just to see if it's still connected.
What was it? What was he doing that for?
Time.
Yes, periodic. He was disputing me periodically.
Well, he went into
Mr. Modest.
He went into another. He went into this thing today. He was, you know,
a rage.
Rage, a thing. He was.
Well, that wasn't a rage.
It was an internal rage.
That's
not a rage. This is a rage.
Okay, at a very early age, babies know whether their mother is angry or happy. But they have no idea that if it's because of them. That's two separate biggies in terms of recognition of as that little hunk of protoplasm begins to develop an id. They can recognize whether their mother, and it's always the mother, it doesn't matter if it's male or female, it's always the female figure that they connect to. They know whether the mother is angry or happy. And if the mother's angry, they get scared. If the mother's happy, they're happy. Now, because of that, in ancient societies, they never, ever, ever let the child out of the mother's sight. Until the child was, well, minimum death through breastfeeding. Now, again, as we know some examples, that some of the most successful people in history have been the ones, believe it or not, that were breastfed the longest. Was breastfed until he was 8 years old.
Oh, I can imagine what the jokes
There are other examples of
8 years old.
Eight.
That's a little old.
Was it Edison?
Yeah, that's
Edison was Edison was breastfed until he was six. But there's the reason is because of this bonding thing that has occurred. Now the bond was there. The bond was broken. And it's rebonding. Now, by 16 or 18 months, they're aware of whether the feelings are directed at them. So by, say, a year and a half, the kid knows whether or not the mother's mad at them or happy because of them. You understand the difference? Mm-hmm. Now comes the crises. Now there's an... I know it's in here, but... sometimes I can just feel this. It's like the moment the child recognizes that the mother is angry or happy because of them, then the child begins to make offerings.
Yeah.
Mm. And all the child is trying to do is the child from the very earliest thing is trying to make in the spirit what's called the burnt offering. Now, there is no mother in the universe that has the wisdom to know what to do with these offerings. Because if you fawn over them too much, you create a monster. If you ignore them, you create a monster. There's no right way to do this. Do you understand? Now, but the thing that takes place, and this is the first real evidence of shame, and it's pathological shame. It's when the first time the child senses that his offering isn't accepted by the mother. At that point, shame becomes overwhelming in the child. The child believes that it's separate and it can never be again connected. And that epinephrine experience will imprint the memory so that is the first real motivating experience the child has from then on. You understand that? Can you feel, is there a point back, can you feel when your offering wasn't accepted? Now, you know, there's weird things, but this, the earliest thing I can remember from this context was when my father kidded me about the size of my ears, and he called me Dumbo. And I was so mortified, and I was so overcome with shame, you know, that for years I was going to go have plastic surgery in my ears. I mean, now it sounds ludicrous. But I was controlled by that shame for years. Because I was making an offering of myself, and my father put forth, probably jokingly, no, knowing him, it wasn't jokingly, never mind. He made a statement which caused me to know that it wasn't just some offering that wasn't acceptable. I wasn't acceptable.
I remember my father, there was an expression he used to use on me, and it was one his father used on him. I didn't know until 10 years later that it was an expression that meant what it means. He used to say to me, "Well, you certainly got a big head." Well, what I heard was,
"Your head's too big."
I had a head that was too big. I remember looking in the mirror and being convinced that I was some kind of a Wasserkopf. As a kid, I found out what that word was. It's a German word.
It's Wasserkopf.
It was like I was convinced that I was some kind of a Mongoloid. Because he would say,
"Wasserkopf means
over
a water head."
He would say over and over and over, "You have a big head." Or, "Your head is too big for your shoulders." Or, you know.
Of course he was right.
He was just talking about your ego.
Exactly.
No, he was talking about the size of his head. Now, because of this, and you can imagine, just think of the millions of times that transaction occurs in your experience. What that has done, it's created a situation where now still, that child in you knows that its offering isn't acceptable. It's not acceptable. So it produces these incredible feelings of inferiority. I mean, it's only by and this is the thing. And those feelings become self-fulfilling. In other words, you feel that you that way, so that way you'll separate yourself. You separate yourself, and once you've separated yourself, you can't, to yourself, say, "It's something in me." It always has to be something in others. There's another reason. There's another transaction. There's a reason that... And what you've done is you've continually, year after year, time after time, friend after friend, acquaintance after acquaintance, you've slowly but surely wiped out the entire universe in the name of shame. Now, that's what a body has to be. A body has to be this environment, this people that you know will never leave you, and you will never leave. That has to be the foundation before any of these things can be dealt with in a real way. Otherwise, you understand what the word pathological means?
Beyond habit,
it's endemic, it's systemic, it's incurable. Now, all of us are motivated in some way, are controlled by this sense of pathological shame. And it came from all his myriad ways and reasons and stuff, from the perception that we were separate and trying to get back to not be separate. Now, that is the basic lie of the universe. Now, we were talking about psychology. Whether it's psychology or psychiatry or religion or any of these things, they've entered into a conspiracy of sounds. And they call these sounds words, and they've agreed that these words mean these things, and they've put labels on all of these things, all with the effort to try to cause you to be successful without the anchor of time.
Right.
You understand what I'm saying? A therapist can't say to you, "I'm going to be with you for all eternity." So they try and they try very well. I mean, I'm not, don't get me wrong, I'm not against therapy. They try with everything in them to cause you to accept yourself, but you have this foundation thing that says something's wrong. And it can't be fixed as long as you know that the therapist, the one that's telling you this, you know he's going to leave you.
Right.
And I'm talking to the seminal portion of you, not some conscious portion of you.
I had three therapists. One of them was a psychologist, a woman, who left the practice and left me sitting because she wanted to go get married. She had a fight with the psychiatrist she was working for. The second one was a therapist. It was a woman. And she tried to get me to go to bed with her. And the third one was my psychiatrist. And while he was in charge of me and my case, he was smoking marijuana, drinking champagne, doing uppers, doing downers, and ended up in Timberland.
Well, again, there has to be this component where and again, we're talking at this core level of our being. There has to be this component that we know that there is a common anchor. Because it's only when that common anchor goes. I mean, the only reason that, you know, that, again, that I can talk to some of you like I do is you know that I'm always going to be here. And you know that, well, maybe you don't, but you know you could say anything you wanted to me and it's not going to affect whether or not, you know, that we're going to be together. That's what you have to know so that you no longer fear me. You understand? I don't fear any of you. Can you believe that?
What? Yeah, I think we can believe that.
Why?
Because I think for that very reason. I mean, you know.
Probably because you don't.
Yeah.
You don't care whether we're with you.
No, that's not true. I care more than anything in the universe that you're here, because I feel we've been together from the beginning. But what I care more about is that you know that. I know that you're being in a bad mood or whatever isn't going to affect whether or not we're together. You don't know that about me.
Yeah.
Because of the office. The purpose of being together over time is so that office can that's why it's called the Bama, the low seat. So the office can go bye-bye. And so the fellow, that's what's happening Stealth. I mean, for the most part. You know, it took a long time. It's probably because Stealth was weenies. But we're weenies.
Weenies.
Anyway, but I mean, can you, John or Josanna, they're not afraid of me.
Yes.
So we're weenies.
Still is weenies.
But anyway, that's not what I'm going to talk about.
Weenies.
No. I want the only thing that can happen, and the transaction that has to take place, is that. Everything of the lie of separation has to be gone to the cross. Now, what that means is, it means that it's only in the abandonment of yourself. That's the rule. That's God's little rule book says that. It's only when you abandon yourself and pick up your cross that following Him is possible. And therefore, the fulfillment of the desire of your heart is possible. If you dwell on trying to fix this thing, what happens? What you do is you give it more power.
Right.
So that's why we only do what we are talking about here, this stuff, normally once a year. Because it's necessary, so it's brought up to see if there's anything that's resurrected itself since last Passover. But fundamentally we know that there's no transaction that's going to fix it. Now, the only thing that's going to fix it is the idea that Jesus Christ, the Son, and God the Father, and the Holy Spirit, the action, was with you, and you find it, and you know that from the very beginning. Now, that's why it says, I wrote unto you fathers, because you've known Him that is from the beginning. You've been with Him from the beginning. And that's why if you walk in the light as He is in the light, then have you fellowship one with another, because you realize that you have been with Him from the beginning. Do you understand? So that in your entire life, you've never been without. I've never, as disgusting as it seems, in my entire life, I've never been without Harry. In my entire life, for the future, I can never be without Tyra. I mean, that transaction is what it means when it says, I write unto you fathers. Remember, I write unto you little children, darling infants, because your sin is forgiven. You have now the capacity to forget about yourself. I write unto you adolescents in the midst of the crap, when everything's going wrong, nothing's right, everything's upside down, inside out, sideways, everything's going wrong, you can't figure out anything. I write unto you adolescents because you know the Father. Fellowship doesn't help, Bible study doesn't help, talking doesn't help, nothing helps. The only thing that helps is the anchor that you know the Father. I write unto you young men, or young adults, because you are strong, and the word of God abideth continually in you, and you've overcome the evil one. I write unto you fathers, because you've been with him from the beginning. It's only when you know you've been with him from the beginning that you can reproduce yourself.
Right.
Otherwise, you are subject to all of your own peculiarities. Now, so what are we saying? What we are saying that in spirit, we have to get back to, in each of our little units, moon units, earth units, to the point where the first time you recognize that you were separate and your offering wasn't accepted. That's the source of your shame. Now, again, the shame is varying, because the shame, if it's your offering isn't accepted, that's one kind of shame that's normally you can just sort of hide. But if a transaction occurred where it wasn't just your offering that wasn't accepted, you weren't accepted, then the shame is pathological.
I know exactly what you're, I mean, I can feel it. I mean, I know exactly what you're talking about, but I'll never be able to remember.
Well, you don't have to. You know, that's one of the things we don't have to go back and bring it to life. Or what happens is, by the willingness to explore it, by the willingness to give it, whatever it is, you're telling God the Father and God the Holy Spirit that you're ready to share it. Even the darkness. That's why it was so important to share her whatever things she's going through. Because otherwise, she'd just feel like she's separate out there, and we wouldn't share her experiences. I told her.
Can imagine how to dredge that up.
I mean, you don't have to. It may, if the Holy Spirit brings to mind, you confess it. You don't have to bring it up in detail. You know, you may have a poor memory.
But it's almost like, almost like you can't, or I can't, until I can see that, it's like nothing can happen.
Well,
I mean, that's what it seems like to me.
I know, it seems impossible. What I said, I mean, God is greater than your fears. I mean, that's what you have to see. You believe at that, when we think in that level, we think that we are greater than God, or that at the bottom line. What God is saying to us is, God is greater than those fears. God, remember we had to go to court this morning. And Tyra is just, she's a basket case. We had to go to court for her ticket. And she's a basket case. And after it was reasonably successful and everything went well. But afterwards, she was still nervous. And I said, I pray for the day when you can go anywhere and be any place and never be nervous. And that's our heritage. That's our rightful inheritance. You know, we know that we have that inheritance. We know we have a right to possess it. We sometimes don't know we have a right to dwell in it 24 hours a day. Instead of just smelling it every once in a while. It's like, now, does everybody understand? I mean, are you in a...
Susan Bauer, you know, she had the wedding dress fiasco. And she bought the wedding dress for $200, $290. And, of course, she didn't use it. And she's had it all this time. We've been trying to figure out what we could do. How could we get Powell to tap dance these people into giving us some credit, blah, blah, blah. I talked to Judy about it this morning. And the dress has been sold, and it's been sold for $200. And the way it got sold was that Susan had advertised the dress 2 months ago in the Green Sheet. Some woman picked up a two-month-old issue of the Green Sheet, opened it up, saw the ad, called her, and paid her $200 for the dress. I tell that story because, I mean, God caused this woman to pick up a two-month-old paper and see it. So it can certainly cause me to remember something when I was 6 months old. You were 18
now,
months.
Yeah, and again, the reason...
Or not.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. You don't... Hear this. The thing that... The transaction that takes place, it has to be... At first, it's fear. You're afraid not to. And that's normally what takes place in what the first levels of hot seats are. I mean, you're afraid of me. You're afraid of my eyes. You're afraid of something. You're afraid of some ooh-you stuff. Or, you know, here's Harry. Harry's convinced I have some kind of...
You do.
You're right.
It's called mojo.
Mojo?
That this guy at the... This guy in Oklahoma at the Rio Motel, he was convinced. You got that mojo. I know you've been making my room hot and cold. You've been making the cold when it's hot. And I know what you're doing.
You can't relax.
I need something to relax. He thought we were bringing in pot, see. So he wanted something to relax. He thought all those bags of trash that we were bringing into the room was marijuana.
That's why we were wearing rubber gloves so we wouldn't absorb it.
Yeah. Yeah, and having that, you know.
The need plastic surgery.
That is what you do when you deal in buff bags.
Oh, yeah.
Especially when it's Maui Waui.
Working on something
big. Working on a chain gang.
Oh, God.
Now, the thing that all of you have can touch or experience is that this feeling of inferiority, I can't say that word. What?
Inferiority.
Your feelings of being inferior.
Non-superior. Short.
Those processes, that transaction, then carries into your relationships or your marriage.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And then what happens is you begin to believe that your well-being is a function of the other partner, that you cannot exist without that other partner. The moment, and love songs think that's wonderful. I mean, but the practical matter is that that is the fruit of pathological shame. The idea that you can't be complete without that other person, and it can only produce death. Now, that's the reasons that marriages and relationships fail. It's because you tend to believe that you are not complete without the other person, if you're on that side. And if you're on the other side, the idea that you feel that you are not complete without the person that you feel you're not complete with, what you've done is consume that person's flesh. And pretty soon, boom. Now, the only way that relationships can exist in a body is for that to be confessed so that each day is new. Each moment is new. But the idea that you bring in the inferiority into a relationship dooms it from the start. Because by definition, you will believe that the other person has to be your sustenance. And it's death. So anyway, what happens is this shame causes men or women to feel dependent on the spouse for identity and the ability to function. If something goes wrong with the other person, they become immobilized. If something is perceived wrong in the relationship, they become stone. Now, without spouse, they would be overwhelmed. Spouse or significant other or boyfriend, they'd be overwhelmed. It would be disorganized. And at the same time, they're then ashamed of that dependency. Then humiliated by remarks that make them feel incompetent, then react with rage, judgment, and violence.
That's like, you know, that's it. Bingo. MO. That's my MO lately.
Okay. It's been recognized. It's been spoken.
Yeah.
Now, it's done with. It's perceived that what's happening in judgments and rage has nothing to do with her. It's responding to your own shame.
You know what? You know what you said the other day about it. You've said this many times, and it's finally starting to hit home. You know, the magic bullet thing, you know, and fixing it and everything. And it isn't fixed. It isn't going to be fixed. And I've been, you know, I've been able to see that the last couple of days. It hasn't gone away or anything, but it's like now I'm in a different place. It's like I'm waiting on him for something, or I don't know. But
well, again, the secret is to know that you have to die daily.
Yeah.
Not just once
not
a day.
Just, right.
I mean, again, in some sometimes the sin offering was made, you know, 400 or 500 times a day in the temple.
You know what was weird though? This is weird. I was driving home today. I guess it was today.
No,
I
didn't even go home today.
Okay, well, I had to go home for some reason.
You had to go home this morning to change the tire.
Right, but it was either today or yesterday.
Is it?
But lately, it's like in my mind, it's been, you know, get thee behind me, Satan. It's been like a fucking mantra with me. I mean, it's just like blam, 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 blam. And I was driving along, and I don't even know what was going on. And all of a sudden, I heard, get thee behind me, Satan. This little voice. And it was like, I didn't say it to myself to absorb myself or anything. It just, I just heard it, and I went, whoa! That was really bizarre. Just to,
that was
you know,
me. I had invited you.
Oh. Okay, well, it was real spiritual at first. It was Satan.
Yeah, Satan saying, get thee behind me, Satan. That makes sense. The thing that the real destruction comes when the parents or the partners or the spouse, whatever, or even your friends begin to use shame as a weapon. It's dead. That's just total death. Now, shame has been the motivating. I mean, a whole lot of very, very successful people became successful by being driven by this pathological shame. I mean, I know some of them. I mean, John Tower was like that. He could never like himself. He could never be at peace with himself. Ross Perot was like that.
Or Maria Callas was like that.
Yeah, he could never. Yeah, they can never be at peace. They can never, because the drive for success is to prove that by fame or money or fortune, or celebrity even, or notoriety, or some other component or wealth, they're gonna run from that thing that's chasing. Well, the thing that's chasing them is internal.
Right.
Well.
Elvis was
sure.
Very much like
that. I think he's still
alive.
He just runs through Dunkin' Donuts.
He's a healing ball.
But they hope to convince themselves of their worth by the idea that somebody else believes something good about them. Mm-hmm. And it never works.
Because they never believe it.
They don't believe. They know it's not true.
Now, entire families can feel a common sense of shame. They can share it. They can share this feeling. It's never spoken. Over divorce, when I was a kid, I mean, if somebody was divorced, it was like,
or suicide, or mental illness.
Or somebody in your family had committed suicide. Or someone had a child, or someone, really, the idea of a child that was mentally ill. And so they would secretly put the child in, you know. But all of these things that produced a sense of shame that was overwhelming, that was common, shared, but it was never spoken.
Yeah.
That's what that whole movie, Prince of Tides, is about. It's about a shared family shame that, you know, causes the family to crack up.
And that sense of shame can persist over many generations, and especially in some of the larger extended families. The implicit rule, don't talk about it or any painful experience. When families get together, don't talk about it.
It's probably what caused World War II, the national shame after World War I.
Now, when you internalize shame, what the fruit of the internalizing of the shame is, it has to have an outflow that's redemptive. And so it's redemptive by setting impossible standards for yourself, becoming a workaholic, demanding impossible situations and standards for you to achieve. Making lists is a big one. You make a list knowing you'll never, but and I'm saying this for Harry, obviously, but you defeat yourself. The shame is the component that says, I'm not worthy, and yet you make the impossible standards that you think you can do, and then you sabotage it so that you always, it's a continuum, it's just a circle. Then you have somebody like me that comes around and makes fun of you for it.
He keeps adding shit to your list.
Why would you do that?
Sometimes 20 or more a day.
55.
Ah!
The beach. That's his list. He's making a list of 50 things.
Now it's 55.
50 things
a day.
Can't do a good work.
You want to come down?
One of the things, put down on the things I like to do, make lists.
Laugh at Harry's misfortune.
That now, again, the reason that we go through this experience of commonality, of shared experience here, and it's true, I mean, you gotta eventually see it, is that the only anecdote for shame is laughter.
Right.
When you can laugh at the thing that you are ashamed of, it loses its power. And it's really, I mean, it's the opposite of what you want to do. You don't want to do this. Now, the freedom comes when you're able to laugh at your own accounts of shame and humiliation.
Yes.
And it's massive freedom. You know, there's most people don't have a look of shame. I mean, you don't. There's a blank expression, a hiding of the face. But like some people are fortunate, they have a look. And that look, it can be, you don't want to look that way, but you're really, but most people don't. Most people don't have an expression for shame. Harry cannot hide shame. I mean, it's like, it's written in, no, I don't know if he can hide it to anybody else, but he certainly can't hide it to me. I mean, the moment there's shame. Now, shame persists then in those who are unable to laugh at themselves. You know, that's why we as a people have to be able to make fun of ourselves. We can't take ourselves seriously.
You know, it's like Friday night before Passover is sort of a test of all the stuff you've done all year. You know what I'm saying? If you can laugh at all the stuff that you've done. I mean,
oh, yeah.
It's like the final thing, you know what I mean? That's the final, and then you can go to Passover.
Now, the laughter alleviates a lot, but the real freedom of shame, from shame, is when the person can admit them openly to others and feels respected instead of judged. Now that's a transaction that can't be faked. It can only be it can only be, in one sense, it's the real reason that a body has to abide. So that you're respected for it instead of judged by it. You understand? Now, again, go back in your minds to that time when you, as a child, you perceive that your mother or your mother figure, you knew she was happy, you knew she was sad. And then just shortly thereafter, you know when you're the cause of it. Now, somehow, by the grace of God, this season, this Passover season, we must get to that point so that we know that the offering that is made at that point was Jesus Christ. And it was made to the Father, and it wasn't to any other transaction. And can you see now why spiritually it says call no man on earth father, but it also implies 100 places call no woman on earth mother, because this has to be our mother for this transaction to be real. Now, I don't know how to do this. I don't know whether we're going to do lists or how we're going to do it. I'll have to think about it. But just be open to the Spirit of God to go back to these painful experiences. I can only promise you that, I mean, these, again, the goal of this hot seat for us is to make the hot seat only hot for the lie. So that the lie of separation in you becomes unbearable. You can no longer believe that lie anymore. So that you can know that there is therefore now no condemnation to those who are in Christ Jesus. Okay? Anybody have any thoughts?
I'm curious where the formula has come from. When you're 18 months, and then when you...
Well, I spent a lot of time studying the...
Ephraim hit this, and then you were ashamed.
Well, epinephrine experience is by definition, I mean, it's an experience when the epinephrine is a hormone that seals a memory into your brain. It doesn't have to be in your consciousness, it seals it and it becomes one of the motivators. I mean, this is common knowledge. It's a chemical phenomenon that occurs in strong emotion. The 16 to 18 months is, you go any freshman psychology book. I mean, that was my minor in college.
Let's have some fun with Sherry though. It's in Isaiah.
Look it up.
All of the stuff about shame, however, is a shame is the thing that most. It's the signature of Jesus Christ in his last moments on earth before the crucifixion. And you don't hear this very often, but he became shame. That's why he opened not his mouth, because of the shame of the moment. That's why, that's why when the scriptures say he despised the shame, he finished its course. Because he finished its course by his one offering, then we are perfected forever. We don't have to experience it once we see that he experienced it. He did it. Now, know, whether or not where this stuff comes from, it comes from, I mean, I didn't go read a book. I mean,
well, Jill's real. I mean, it's experienced. I mean, when he says that, it's just like something in me just says, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, this has been something that's been done by almost everybody in the group. So,
well, for years.
Yeah, for years. And I mean, yeah.
It's
freedom. I mean, it's the real thing. It's not.
Well, and it's amazing the things that will come out that I remember.
Yeah, and people. I mean, the things that, you know, that you think about that you're ashamed of and you wouldn't want anybody else to know. I mean, if you really look at them, it's so easy to see how binding they are. You know, how much bondage they put you in to that, oh my God, everybody's going to know type feeling. You know, the one that just is like, if they know that, they'll never ever accept me. Or if they know that, you know.
But not the things which are seen, but the things which are unseen. And it's like, you know, there's an internal witness. You know, I mean, that's the only thing that's kept you here. But, you know, in this place, this stuff that we're talking about now, more than anything else, there's such a strong internal witness, you know, that you can't deny the validity of the...
Well, see, that's what it is with me. And I don't know, exactly. I don't want to say that it's because of my Baptist background. I don't really know what it is, but I don't feel like I kind of. It's hard to describe, but it's hard for me to think or believe that there's validity to this. Because, you know, Christ died for all of that and it's taken care of, so why throw it up into the air? I mean, it's...
Because
it still causes us not to believe that.
Because you don't...
It causes a separation. We don't believe that it's all taken care of.
Can you put your eyes back on
because
yourself?
We do.
Let me show you. Go to Ezekiel 8. I'll show you why. You understand that there's a misconception that is fundamental to what your belief system is, and it's so total that it is causing you great pain, and it's the proof system that you are what you believe, and the belief system that you have is that salvation is the end. Salvation is the hope for. Salvation is the thing that you work towards, or the end result of humanity. In this theology that you're a part of now, salvation isn't the end, it's only the beginning. But that's, and you shake your head, yes, but you don't believe it. Your questions indicate that you believe salvation is the end. Well, you couldn't have asked that question that you asked, that Christ died for us and it's all finished. I mean, it's all finished, but you don't know it. You think that believe the Lord has forsaken you in the areas that it aren't successful by your definition.
Well, I mean, I know that there are times when I have to remind myself to try to see God in everything. If I like it, if I don't like it, if I understand it, if I don't understand it. But.
Yeah, but. There's a. I know you'll probably hate me for this word, but there's a Pollyannish.
In me?
It's a Pollyannish religion. It's a Pollyanny. I can even say Pollyanna kind of theology.
Yeah.
And it is a lie. The Pollyanna theology denies suffering and acts like everything is all right. And therefore, there can never be any real giving. You can only be giving that's been doctored up to look pretty.
And you're not the only one in this room. And that's why we do these things, to just get rid of all that bullshit.
But also, to knit the body together in love. And you know, we think we know what's gonna bring that to happen. But it's like God, he fakes us out. And he says, you're suffering. And you know, sharing whatever's there, that's what's going to get you together in love. But it's like, you know, it's the process that convinces us. It's the process that shows us. I mean, there is no sin that's not common to all men, and that's the only reason. It's the only reason anybody in here can say anything to you, because it is common, mm-hmm. completely.
But I would ask you to reacquaint yourself with what you believe. I mean, you really don't believe what you say you believe.
Yeah.
You've just now started an incredible journey. The only enemy is here. And there has to be at least 3, maybe 4 witnesses for everything that's said. If there isn't, discard it. Not 4 people, but 4 sources. The body is only one witness. The word is another. Your private revelation, the private thing in you, is another. Another, though, is the only evidence that we have of what a church should look like, which was the very first century documents. You understand that nothing modern has any historical validity. There's no historical validity for any of the churches today to look like they are. So, I've spent 20 years studying massively to have 4, maybe 5 witnesses for everything that's said. It started with me as a private revelation, and that was worthless. It was tested by the Word, and it was found to be true. But that's not enough. Then it was tested by the first century documents, and that still wasn't enough. It had to be tested then in a body of people for years, abiding, knowing everything about us. So, it's a big deal. This reporter called me today, and he started crying on the phone. And he said, I've just been looking at my notes, and I've just realized what it is that you guys have done. The idea of what has happened here is massive, mm-hmm. historically. Anyway, I want you to question every element, question everything. But I would also ask you to look at the source from which the questions came from. Okay. Anyway, can everybody agree that this is something we should do? Is there anybody that has any doubts about it? Do you have any doubts?
No.
Okay.
What were you going to show us in Ezekiel
8? Oh, Ezekiel 8. Just read. You read. No, I'll show you. You read Ezekiel 8 with clear understanding. We'll decide by next week what form we're going to take with regard to whether a list is going to be made of some kind. The list only serves a purpose to cause your mind to start.
I keep expecting a spell to happen and he keeps waving it. Ah, I'm going to spell.
Either that or he catches
Elizabeth!
First thing you ever hear is your list of superficial is the UA.
Say it again. Some people hear that.
Yeah. Harry hears that all the time.
Breakfast meat.
You're at the touch sheet superfluous with
that one. Yeah. The other thing that we will do is when we all finish the first fruit stuff and the acetate stuff, then we will have a time when it's all common so that we talk about it so that everybody knows so we can exhort each other.
So when are we doing that?
We haven't decided yet. It'll be during February and March, during that.
Are we going to go away or are we going to do it nightly?
I don't know. What do you want to do? What's your pleasure?
Remember it.
Because normally there's a period of some kind of a traumatic period in your life that you forget the things before it.
I mean, I can hardly remember anything.
Like neither one of them can remember before they were 10 years old, which is really weird.
Yeah, they can't even be hypnotized.
You've never done that.
What?
I don't see myself as an age.
Yeah, well, some people don't. It's like a flowing.
Yeah.
And you.
Yeah.
Yeah, and don't worry about it. That's you don't have to worry about age. Just think, things will come up. Take a big guy.